Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, the Free Markets series. You may agree or disagree, but I think you will rarely read a more ringing defense and a more convincing defense of free markets and capitalism than right here in the book, How Capitalism Will Save Us, by former presidential candidate Steve Forbes. I met him at Forbes magazine in Lower Manhattan. Here he is. Steve Forbes, we always quote from the book when we start a book interview, and this is How Capitalism Will Save Us is a wonderful read, but thank I'm just going to read the table of contents because in a way it kind of tells the story and it does the interview for me. Every chapter asks a question that is often asked. Example, is capitalism moral? Isn't capitalism brutal? Aren't the rich getting richer at other people's expense? Aren't higher taxes the price we pay for a humane society? Don't regulations safeguard the public good? Aren't free trade and globalization destroying American jobs? Is affordable health care possible in a free market? And finally, isn't government needed to direct the economy? A lot of people think those things, and so you tackle that head on. You say the rap against capitalism, and here's the reality. Why did you decide to do it that way?
Well, we wanted something with my co-author Elizabeth Ames that would be like a conversation that you would have around a kitchen table. And so instead of getting in economic jargon, what are the kind of common questions? Most people believe in free markets, but they don't have all the knowledge, and certainly schools don't teach it very well. So people have questions about it. Okay, deal with the questions and answer them in a way, colloquial way, so people get a better understanding. And with better understanding, hopefully, someday we'll get better economic policies.
And indeed, people do believe, when you question them a bit, they like free markets, they like the whole idea, they understand that capitalism and democracy have been for the good of humanity. And yet all these truisms, though, these skeptical truisms and the questions, they also believe that. So how did that happen? I mean, people have been knocking capitalism for as long as it's been functioning.
Well, in one sense, the culture always attacks the so-called powerful. And going back to biblical times, no one likes landlords. No one likes money changers. And indeed, it wasn't until modern capitalism rose up that a system rose up where you didn't have a stratified society, but where you had mobility and the ability to be creative, innovative, and do things that never have been thought of before. And so a lot of the raps go back to that, but also they come out of the Great Depression. The Great Depression was seen as a failure of free markets. We explain in the book, no, as a massive failure of government policy that brought it on. But like this current crisis, free markets get the rap for it.
And there's one dramatic example you gave, and when I started reading, even I was a little bit incredulous, concerns Chile and Pinochet, and you say in the end this brutal dictator was undone by the very free market that he set up.
He thought he could have it both ways. He thought he could have political control and also, though, bring in the kind of principles and policies that make for a prosperous society. He thought the prosperity would redound to him. What it did was create a middle class, and in any society where people start to have prosperity and make their own decisions, they figure, well, if I can choose where I wish to live or what car I want to buy, why can't I choose my local leaders? Why do I have to do what they tell me instead of my making my choices? So free markets start to create habits that fall into the political sphere. You saw the same thing unfold in South Korea, once a tough authoritarian regime, Taiwan. And I think you're eventually going to see it unfold in China. That's one reason why politically governments in these countries that try to have it both ways oftentimes become very harsh, because they want the prosperity, but they don't like what comes out of it.
And Pinochet himself, as you point out, was dumbfounded to be voted out in that referendum.
He thought, since he had done such a great job over the years, he decided to have a referendum. He knew there was popular discontent, so he said, all right, let's have the vote. And he thought the people would say, oh, you've done such a great job, we shall keep you in as military dictator. Mm-hmm. No, they threw him out. And he had to go in exile.
And that's right. And you mentioned China. A lot of people, there's a big question mark there. We don't know really what's bubbling under the surface there. We know some of the numbers are fudged, are probably fudged. But yet, they have, let's face it, they've made a lot of money off us, certainly. And they do seem to be having it both ways for now compared, let's say, to Russia, which really went to pot. Are you sort of predicting that that will blow at some point?
Well, in terms of China, the regime's legitimacy is now totally tied to ever-increasing prosperity. And especially when you have a turbulent time, that becomes more and more difficult to do. You have, on the one hand, the coastal cities doing very well, rising middle class, growing property rights. One of the reasons why the communists had to allow more property rights was people start to ask questions. If we buy an apartment in Shanghai, what does it mean? Does it mean we own it forever? Does it mean we can sell it when we wish? Does it mean we can give it to our kids? What does it mean? So it brought about reforms that a lot of the party apparatchiks weren't happy with at all. And so, yes, China is moving ahead. But the very fact that you are creating growing middle classes, the very fact you're creating expectations, means that people do want the ability to start making their own decisions. There's a lot of corruption, which you get with an authoritarian regime. There's not much recourse people have, so social unrest, as the government acknowledges, they have a lot of it. It's one reason why they have corruption trials and shoot a lot of corrupt officials to try to appease the population. But people don't like it on the local level when somebody comes in and says, we're going to do a deal with a developer and take your land. Boom, it's done. People say, "What?" In effect, they don't use the words. In fact, is where's due process? Where? What's in it for us? We thought this was ours.
And a lot of our entrepreneurs are turning off to China. Some are doing well, but some are coming back a bit bitter for that very reason.
Well, China still is in the infant stage of developing what we call here commercial law, contract law. You have a dispute. You have an agreement. One thing we take for granted in this country is that if I make an agreement with you, in effect, the government will enforce it. That's kind of a novel thing when you think about it in the course of human history. Private contract, but it's got the force of law. China's in the infant stage of that. It's still very political, a lot of those decisions. And so you have real problems on intellectual property rights, real problems on stealing of technology, real problems when you have a dispute. Can you get a fair adjudication of it? So doing business in China, like anything in this real world, is no slam dunk.
And you dissect very well the 08 and 09 crisis, and you impugn, well, you know, Freddie Mac and the sort of the overblown, the bubble that the government created. But you do say, even though normally we like to let bad things fail, in this case, the government was right to rescue the financial system. Now, coming from you, that was a bit surprising.
Well, those are the key words, financial system. The cause of the crisis, the biggest one, which still is not understood today, was the Federal Reserve printing too much money. When you do that, you get a flight of money into hard assets. Last time we had a big housing boom was in the 1970s when we last had an inflation. So it distorts the flow of capital. So you have this artificial boom in housing. Standards go down. Then you have Freddie and Fannie come in, underwriting a lot of this junk. So that makes the bubble even bigger. And eventually it explodes. But the key thing to understand on all of this is that the Federal Reserve had done its thing right, kept the dollar as good as gold. You did not have the government distorting the market, saying, we want more home ownership, and ending up destroying the market. I mean, other countries like Canada have higher rates of home ownership than we do, and they don't do any of this kind of junk that we think we have to do to encourage home ownership. People will do it on their own, thank you very much. And so you get a full-blown crisis. Now, having developed the crisis, then the question becomes, all right, the thing implodes, and we also discuss another arcane thing. Hope this doesn't turn off all your listeners, but mark-to-market accounting, which was destroying bank capital, something had to be done, because what you're going to do is you're going to punish the innocent with the guilty. One thing about a financial system is very closely tied together.
Yeah.
So you had something we hadn't had in 7,500 years, a panic. People withdrawing money from their money funds. They didn't care where they put it. They just wanted the cash. People didn't care about the gold. They just wanted to have a coin. And so the thing could implode. So it's like, in that sense, it's like a natural disaster. You deal with the immediate disaster. You throw in food, medicine, housing, you know, tents and water, clean water. But it doesn't mean you do it forever. You deal with the specific crisis. If the government did right in 2008, they'd have immediately suspended mark-to-market. Congress forced them to do it in early 09, and when they did, the market took off. So if they had suspended or gotten rid of mark-to-market, made it very clear they're not going to let the whole system collapse, even though particular players would go down, as they, some of them eventually did, the crisis would have been over in October.
So rescue was good, but stimulus is like the son of rescue gone bad. Is that they kept on rescuing.
Yes. Stimulus is like steroids. It gets to another thing we discuss, is the idea that government can guide the economy. When you say stimulus, where does the money come from? It sort of sounds like it comes out of nowhere. Ha ha, we have stimulus. No, it comes from people. It doesn't come from Mars. Where do they get the money? They either get it from taxing or borrowing it or printing it, which is another form of taxation.
Mm-hmm.
So in effect, the politicians take resources from you, put it through the political sausage factory, spit it out in a very inefficient way, and that's supposed to stimulate an economy. It does not. It did not do it in the 30s. Did not do it this time, manifestly. Japan's had about 15 of these things in the last 20 years. They've all failed.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're repaving roads for the fourth time. Let the markets work, and they will work.
And how much, if we need to rescue the system, how much pain should there be? However, let's say we're very disciplined about rescuing. We do what needs to be done, like you say, clean water and tents for the banks, and we stop, and the bad stuff has to go down. How much pain is in there?
Well, no more pain than when any company goes broke. It happens all the time. Small businesses, big businesses. It doesn't bring the system down. It's too bad for the creditors. Too bad if you have to find a new job because the company went broke. But it doesn't mean it's the end of the financial or the world, or it doesn't mean the end of the economy. So early in 2009, GM and Chrysler should have gone through a normal reorganization after all. All of the major airlines, except so far American, have gone through at least one or two bankruptcies. They didn't cease flying. people didn't cease flying on them. It meant you reorganized, redid your balance sheet, renegotiated contracts, and if you emerged from the process, you hoped you'd do better next time.
And when we discussed years ago together the gold standard, that was very, very much a minority view, but reality seems to be catching up to you. You make a good case for the discipline of it. It's kind of, to a lot of people, it seems antiquated, but then when you think it over, you say, why is it antiquated if it works?
Well, what it does is give you a stable value for your money. Money doesn't come from government. Money comes from people doing transactions with one another. You give me, I want an apple. You give me the apple. You might want a pear in return, but I might only have a half a dozen eggs. So that means you have to take the half a dozen eggs, go around and find somebody who'll trade you the eggs for the pears. And, it's very cumbersome, whereas with money just makes it very fast. So it should be a fixed measure of value, like 60 minutes in an hour.
Mm-hmm.
You don't change the number of minutes in an hour each day. It would be very, complicated.
Yeah.
So gold both gives you stability but also flexibility. If the economy is booming, you, in effect, people do more transactions. That means you're creating more money. Gold allows for that when properly done.
And I'm told the U.S. having,
By the way, when the government starts mucking around with the money, which the Federal Reserve is doing as we speak today, that's like putting a virus in your PC or your Mac. It corrupts the information.
There's too much money sloshing around, obviously.
Yeah.
That's too much debt, and the stimulus only added to that. And everybody's sort of very scared. But how would it happen to put... The United States has more gold reserves than anyone else, so that would actually be a boon to the American debt. But how would you have a conference? Would you declare it? Getting off it was pretty simple, but how would you get back onto it?
It's almost as simple as going off of it. That is, you say you're going to do it. You don't need to own 1 ounce of gold. What you do, I'm picking a number now, let's say the price is determined to be $1,800 an ounce.
Mm-hmm.
What that would tell the markets is if it goes much above 1,800, the Fed's going to tighten up, withdraw money from the system. If it goes much below 1,800, they're going to add to it. So it keeps it at that steady pace. It's
If the U.S. did it, would everybody else have to sort of follow?
No. The U.S. is of a size where it could do it alone. Others would, just as out of convenience. Most countries informally tie to the dollar just because it makes trade and the flows of capital much easier.
Mm-hmm.
But so if the U.S. does it, you don't have to have a conference. The dollar is the global currency. When we start trashing, it's very disruptive. And that's what makes the Chinese and others so unhappy. There's not much they can do about it. So by having the gold steady...
They might welcome
welcome it, make their lives easier. The Europeans would. I mean, one of the things that happens when you unhinge money is you get a lot of borrowing, which is why they're now having sovereign debt crises over there, and they haven't mm-hmm. figured out how to work that out. It just has a lot of bad after effects.
But I don't hear any political... It sounds so good. Of course, it's discipline, so discipline is good but tough. I still don't hear any political will out there. I don't hear leaders of any of these countries saying the gold standard. Why not?
Well, part of it is they've been taught gold is bad. gold was a victim, another victim of the Great Depression. The U.S. has been on a gold standard of one sort or another for 180 years. And we went from 3.9 million rural area to the mightiest nation in the history of the world, but somehow gold was seen as bad. And that's the way. So policy elites think, oh, this would be the end of the world. And well, they're doing a pretty good job without any type of gold and not mucking things up.
And there are many, as I mentioned.
The other thing they don't like is it restrains their ability to spend.
Yes, of course.
It's real money, so they can't print it and, you know, play politics with it.
And
bottom line is, what do you trust, gold or Washington politicians or European politicians?
Well, that's
or
an
Asian
easy one.
Politicians.
But gold's not running for office. That's the problem. as I mentioned, you debunk a lot of the myths about capitalism, and one that keeps coming back, and it's about modern economies in general, is that somehow a lot of innovation kills more jobs than it creates. And you take, here's one example for the audience: ATMs created more bank teller jobs than they eliminated. That's incredible, but it's true, and I didn't know that. I learned it from the book. Let's just take that example.
Well, what it does is free people up from doing what you might call really routine work, deposits, cashing checks, and that kind of thing, and frees them up to do more specialized things. And on any kind of innovation, what it does is free up resources for other things. And so, yes, it may be disruptive. We talk about the iPod and what it did and all the offshoots to what it's done to stores and what it's done to traditional ways of distributing music. But technology did it, but it also means when you buy music now, you get what you actually want. You don't have to buy 15 other songs you did not want.
Yeah.
You can buy the one you want.
And you don't leave home.
And you don't leave home, so it's a great convenience. So it frees up resources for other things. So when people just focus on either the side that it where it does destroy jobs or on the disruptive side, they overlook the fact it's a huge convenience. I mean, it's a miracle. We sit here and we take it for granted. We can get fruit from all around the world, not items, but fruit. And all of these products and services, all at our fingertips. Talking to the world with our fingertips. Geographical bounds have been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And human nature being what it is, we think it's the most natural thing in the world that we pop out a phone and call Bangladesh. Okay, yeah, okay, yep. See you whenever. It's amazing.
And the fact that jobs are created, it's always the lag that is painful. I've read descriptions in history books when electricity came, people were scared to death it would destroy jobs. And when the steam engine came and so forth, you can go back in history. But there is a lag for adjustment, education and so on and training. And that's what panics people. And in today's electoral system, politicians thrive on that.
Well, it's always easy to blame somebody if change comes. Fortunately, in the United States, we've always had a belief in progress, that things may be disruptive, but by golly, we are moving forward and life is getting better. And so even the lag, if you have a vibrant economy, it's pretty short, because if you have basic skills, somebody will hire you and teach you what you need to know. And the biggest educator in this economy is not the schools. It's when you get a job, you learn pretty quickly.
And in the book, because there's a lot of humor in there, and I don't want to miss that, you take Gordon Gekko's famous tirade on greed, and you repeat it at the beginning of a chapter as if it's your own, and it's kind of stunning, but then you point out greed and self-interest. There's a point to be made there for you. What is the difference?
Well, when you say self-interest, people conflate it with, confuse it with selfishness. Now, self-interest means you have a certain desire, certain ambitions. But selfishness is not going to get you very far. If you're an entrepreneur, you're the last one to get paid when you start a business. You've got to lay out money for materials, lay out money for if you need a structure. You got to pay people. You got to buy supplies. You've got to go out and market. And then you have to pay off everybody before you get a penny of it. So
And you can fail.
And so, it's your self-interest to have a vibrant business. But if you were selfish, you would just be like Ebenezer Scrooge and clutch the money and not do anything. It's very instructive in that Christmas carol, how decrepit the sign is outside of Scrooge's office. He never was willing to. He's too cramped in his view of life to make the investment, to, in effect, give. realize that true entrepreneurial capitalism means investing as a form of giving. You hope to get something in return, but you have no idea whether you will or not. Greed has taken something that doesn't belong to you. Nothing that's been around for ever since people have been around.
And you point out, you say, you know, in the financial system, we knock Wall Street, and we're probably correct in some cases, but the dishonest bunch in there doesn't bring down the whole system or doesn't impugn the whole system.
No, it's
like a lot of people, it's so intertwined.
Well, because people have ideological agendas trying to discredit the whole system. But it's like saying, occasionally there's fraud in elections. Therefore, let's do away with free elections because some people cheated the ballot box. No, you deal with a particular problem. You don't throw the system out.
And is there any kind of rule anyway that can undo a fraudster and a whizkid? I can't recall. I can't count how many times I've heard people on Wall Street brag when a new, when Sarbanes-Oxley, any kind of new regulation, the Volcker Rule, anything is discussed. They say, hey, listen, on a napkin, give me 30 seconds, I'll find a way around it. And they're proud of this. That's a mindset. Well, what do you do with people like that? They're not helping the system.
Well, there's a difference between fraud. Fraud is illegal. You don't need to pass a bunch of new laws. One of the shortcomings of Sarbanes-Oxley was it put in a lot of new controls, a lot of paper walls, but if somebody's determined to do something wrong, paper walls aren't going to be very effective in stopping them. What it did do was make it extremely expensive for small companies to achieve profitability to go public. Mm-hmm. When you're a small company laying out a couple of $1 million on just waste in terms of extra accounting fees, doesn't do anyone any good except the accountant. And hurts innovation, hurts the people who have the least resources. So in terms of rulemaking, oftentimes you can have a broad rule and everyone knows if you step over the line. It's like you have capital requirements. It's whether it's off-sheet or on the balance sheet, if you're taking responsibility for it, it ought to count against your liability, it ought to count against your capital. It's very basic. You don't need a 2,300-page Dodd-Frank bill to tighten up your capital rules or keep the rules up to date. And that's another thing about keeping rules up to date. Government's always going to be behind innovation because we don't know what it is until it happens. You know, 60 years ago, 55 years ago, the copier was invented by Xerox. Well, you suddenly had to update copyright laws. And so you got the fair use doctrine. We're still coping today mm-hmm. with what technology, what the web has done to distribution of music and video. Still sorting all of that out in terms of use and copyright and things like that, distribution. So innovation brings in the need for new rules of the road, but it doesn't mean you quash the thing. You just figure out, all right, we got this new thing. How do we make sure that it does its good part? And you try to ameliorate or contain the bad parts of it.
And there's also a bit of humor, a sense of humor, in your rebuttal of Warren Buffett's apparent cry of injustice that his secretary pays more tax than he does. You answer something to that.
Well, he actually, in terms of salary, makes less than his secretary. he gets most of his money from dividends and capital gains.
So if he paid a salary, he would pay more.
So if he paid a salary, he'd be paying more. If he paid himself more than a secretary, he would pay more tax than a secretary.
And point out that the dividends, of course, come from money that's at risk and so on.
At risk and capital gains, as we've certainly learned once again in recent years, there's no guarantee of a capital gain in markets. In fact, it's been rather the opposite recently. So when you look at salaried income versus risk income, of course they should be treated differently.
And your central point, I want to end on this, is, and you begin the book with that, capitalism to you is moral, and Milton Friedman had made that point as well, and you quote him. So let's sum up. Why is it moral?
Capitalism is moral because you succeed only by meeting the needs and wants of other people. Even if you're Gordon Gekko and lust for money and are greedy, you're not going to get it unless you're supplying something in a free market that somebody else wants. So without you even realizing it, it forces you to figure out, what, Bob, do you want that I can sell you? So I'm suddenly attentive to your needs and wants. Or coming up with something that you didn't even know you wanted, as Steve Jobs did repeatedly, mm-hmm. with iPads, iPods, iPhones. Who knew if you said iPod 12 years ago, people thought, is this a remake of an alien movie of pod people taking over the world? And so it, in that sense, it is moral. You have to have rules. You have to have a sense of values. If there's no trust, the system will not work. But when you have those values, it is a moral system, meeting the needs and wants of other people.
And listening to them, because you also say we shouldn't snicker cynically at the salesperson who says, have a nice day. They're thinking of you, and that's what they should be doing.
They're trying to be pleasant, to put you in a mood so that you'll buy what they're offering, which makes life pleasant for you. Somebody's attentive to you, not because they love your tie, although you're wearing a great tie. You have resources. They want to exchange their resources for your resources. So you try to be nice to them. And those who aren't usually don't survive too long.
Well, Steve Forbes, let's encourage some people out there not only to have a nice day, but to exchange a few resources to buy How Capitalism Will Save Us, because it's a great book. Thank you so much.
Bob, thank you.
Steve Forbes was our guest this week on the Free Markets series of The World Show. His book, once again, How Capitalism Will Save Us. And that's our program for this week. I'm Bob Scully. Thanks.